KUOW podcasts are made possible by listener support. Become a new or renewing member today at KUOW.org.
A quote, Operation Jericho. The Christian Bible describes Jericho as a closed city with walls that collapsed after a battle won by followers of God. The government news agency of North Korea accused Baek of bringing 250 missionaries into the country to bring down the government and, quote, hurt the dignity of the North Korean leadership. An independent news organization that covers North Korea said this week that Baek told a church in St. Louis he knew Jesus wanted him to, quote, be a channel to the North, unquote. Last week, he was sentenced to 15 years hard labor. The State Department has called for his release, but the U.S. has no diplomatic presence in Pyongyang. A jury in Washington state has convicted an inmate of first-degree aggravated murder in the killing of prison guard Jamie Bendel. Thursday's conviction means that prosecutors could pursue the death penalty against 54-year-old Byron Scherf. The jury will decide next week whether Scherf will face execution or a mandatory punishment of life in prison without release. And the National Weather Service says the second driest start to May on record in Seattle will end in time for Mother's Day. Forecasters say Saturday will likely be the final dry day in a stretch that began April 30th. 11 dry days at the beginning of May would be the second longest period since 1946, when it didn't rain until May 24th. In 1958, May also had a dry start with 9 days without rain. We'll get more on the weekend forecast from state climatologist Nick Bond at 9:50 this morning on Weekday. This is KUOW News. I'm Jamala Henderson.
It's 9:06. I'm Bernard Ouellette. Support for NPR comes from Constant Contact, committed to helping small businesses and nonprofits stay connected to customers using email marketing. Learn more at ConstantContact.com.
Support for KUOW comes from Gordon James Fine Diamonds in Bellevue.
KUOW is a self-sustaining service of the University of Washington.
From 94.9 KUOW Seattle and KUOW.org, I'm Marcy Silman. Today, we're going to inaugurate what we hope will become a regular weekly segment that looks at new science research underway around the country and around our region. We're going to talk today with science journalist Sally James. Also coming up this morning, just after 10 o'clock, our regular panel of journalists joins us to look at the week's news. While Americans wait for the U.S. Supreme Court to announce its decision on the constitutionality of the Defense of Marriage Act, individual states are making their own decisions about gay marriage. Yesterday, the Minnesota House of Representatives passed a same-sex marriage bill. That bill goes to the Minnesota Senate next week. The governor has promised to sign it into law. Last week, Rhode Island became the final New England state to approve gay marriage. These states join Maine, Maryland, and Washington, where voters approved same-sex marriage in November. There's another push for same-sex marriage going on in our country right now among tribal leaders throughout North America. Most recently, in March, a tribe in northern Michigan approved gay marriage. The Little Traverse Bay Band of Ondawa Indians joins Washington State's Suquamish tribe, which made gay marriage legal 2 years ago. What's the relationship between tribal laws and laws that govern marriage in individual states or at the federal level? Wanted to answer that question, so we invited Ron Whitener to join us. He's executive director of the University of Washington's Native American Law Center. Thanks for coming in.
Thank you.
The Suquamish tribe approved gay marriage 2 years ago. So we're talking about a sovereign nation creating its own laws within the context of both a state and federal system. And I was curious sort of what law was prominent, what law was first when we're talking about perhaps members of the Suquamish tribe marrying one another. If Washington State hadn't approved gay marriage, what would be the status of a marriage in the state?
Well, it would be a marriage. The tribes are, if they're recognized by the United States as being sovereign, then the United States will recognize the inherent sovereign powers that they exert, and one of which is over domestic relations, such as marriage. And so if two people get married at Suquamish, they are married. Certainly at Suquamish, they're considered married. And depending on what jurisdiction, what other sovereign agrees to recognize that as a marriage, it's recognized and valid in that other sovereign. And that's just sovereignty is an amorphous, somewhat philosophical thing. And a lot of it is just what each sovereign's willing to recognize from the other.
The Suquamish tribe took this pretty momentous step, it would seem, to legalize or make to recognize the right of gay and lesbian tribal members to marry 2 years ago, 2 years before the voters.
Yeah, and I'm not sure that it was just tribal members. I'm not sure that
could it be anybody? Like, if I wanted,
no, I don't think it could be anybody, but it could very well be the recognition of a marriage between a tribal member and a non-member.
Okay, so but one of the parties has to be a tribal member.
Usually, that's the link that tribes have when they decide to exercise jurisdiction. At least one of the parties in that needs to be a member of the tribe.
Do you know why the Suquamish took this action 2 years ago? What prompted it?
It was a push by one of its members who wanted to marry her partner and understood that at the very least her tribe had the ability to pass a law. And pass a law certainly more quickly than the state of Washington, which is one of the nice things, actually, that I love about working with tribes is that if they do want to change something, they have a process, but the process tends to be faster than practically any other jurisdiction. They can move fairly quickly. And so she was able to lobby her tribal council. Tribes, individuals have a much closer relationship to their elected officials. And she was able to convince them that this was something that the tribe should do.
There aren't that many tribes across the country that do recognize same-sex marriage, are there?
No, not very many. Coquille in Oregon, Suquamish, Little Traverse. I think those are the three that are existing right now. So it is uncommon.
And there are a couple of very big tribes, the Navajo and Cherokee, which have outlawed gay marriage.
Well, they've specifically said they're not going to recognize gay marriage, and under the Defense of Marriage Act have executed statutes which state that they won't give full faith and credit to gay marriage from other jurisdictions that do.
So what happened?
That is, but at least at Navajo, that is up in the air still. There's a push.
Really?
Yeah, there is a push at Navajo now where that's being revisited, and there are community meetings going on, and they are talking about whether or not that should continue to be the policy at Navajo.
Now, you said they've done that under the auspices of Defense of Marriage Act. What happens if the Supreme Court overturns DOMA? Does it have any impact on tribal law?
No. Not really. I mean, the tribes still have the ability to decide whether or not they're going to recognize marriage from another jurisdiction if they want to. I mean, the fact is that many tribes often don't even have domestic relation ordinances related to marriage, depending on where they are. In many of the states, including Washington, through a grant by the United States federal government and through a statute passed by the state of Washington took jurisdiction over domestic relations on the reservation. So on the vast majority of the reservations in Washington, whether you're an Indian married to an Indian and you live on the reservation, you can go into a state court to get a dissolution. So many tribes, my tribe, for instance, it doesn't have a marriage code.
What is your tribe?
Squaxin Island down by Olympia in Shelton.
So your tribe doesn't have a marriage code, then this is up to each individual tribe? I guess what I'm trying to get at is what is that relationship between the state law, in this case Washington state law, for tribes who are located in our listening area, and what they should decide to do themselves?
Well, there is the relationship. There isn't a relationship, really. Each operates independently. Again, it's sort of what one sovereign will recognize from the other. So before the passage of Washington's same-sex marriage law, I mean, that was an issue at Suquamish. If a situation where two people get married and they're in a same-sex marriage at Suquamish, if for some reason they wanted to go into state court prior to the passage of the new law, the state, I don't think, would be able to dissolve that marriage. So they would only be able to have a divorce in the Suquamish Tribal Court.
So now the fact that Washington voters have approved same-sex marriage makes it somewhat easier for Suquamish tribal members.
Right. And I think, you know, I could be wrong, but I think it could open the door to more tribes following down the line of Suquamish because that jurisdictional concern is no longer there. And you can go, if you're married under a tribe's same-sex marriage provisions, you can get a divorce in the tribal court. And for most tribes, again, the vast majority of tribes in Washington, you can go into state court to do it as well.
We're talking about same-sex marriage and tribes, specifically in Washington State, with Ron Whitener, Executive Director of the University of Washington's Native American Law Center. As you were speaking, I just wondered about things like benefits. If you happen to work for a state or municipality agency that provided same-sex benefits before Washington State had same-sex marriage, if you were a married Suquamish tribal member legally under your tribal law, would you be able to get spousal benefits at a non-tribal entity that you might work for?
Yeah, that's an excellent point. And that is something that is a thing that the tribes would have to consider. So for instance, at my tribe, like Suquamish, is a treaty tribe. And so we exercise off-reservation treaty fishing and hunting. And under tribal code at Squaxin, your spouse can go with you when you go fishing commercially. Mm-hmm. I can go with you when you go hunting. I think we also have preferences. So under tribes are exempt from not being able to provide like employment preferences. And so, you know, my tribe creates a preference for its own members, but it also creates, you get a little bit of an added benefit if you're married to a tribal member, if you're applying for a job or things like that. So those benefits that the tribe provides are important in the calculus mm-hmm. that they're going to make when they decide whether or not to do it. Now, the other problem that tribes have is that tribes do have a much closer relationship between the United States federal government, and some of the benefits that we as tribal members are able to access. You know, it'll be interesting to see if the DOMA rules, if they stand with no, you know, recognition of that for federal benefits. I'm not sure what those could affect, but they could affect issues in the area of things like housing and other things. If the tribe gives a preference for someone who's married for a particular type of house under federal law, those federal laws may have an effect.
You mentioned treaty tribes. There are tribes that are not even officially recognized.
Right.
So things would be, they would be in a different category at this point in time.
They are. I mean, from that's a really interesting area. They exercise a certain amount of sovereignty. There's even case law that says that they can be sovereigns, but they're not recognized by the United States. And so but even though philosophically, you know, a tribe could be theoretically a sovereign if they're not recognized, if the United States doesn't recognize them as a sovereign, the United States won't tolerate them acting like a sovereign. So they won't be able to take land into trust. They won't be able to pass laws that restrict the activity of their members or other people.
Mm-hmm.
If they passed any marriage law, the United States wouldn't, and the state wouldn't recognize it as a valid.
So they're seen as being governed by state federal laws and not a code of tribal laws.
They're from the state's point of view, and this varies around the country. There are some states, there's groups that are known as state-recognized tribes, mm-hmm. where the states themselves agree to recognize a particular group as a tribe and then will extend state benefits or have specific relationships, almost like a government-to-government relationship with those groups. From the United States point of view, that doesn't happen. Mm-hmm. And so they will operate as a group of individuals. Often they'll form nonprofits and do everything they can to work as a tribal governmental unit. But there's only so much that they can do if the United States won't recognize their ability to do to exercise inherent sovereignty.
Boy, I'll have you come back in. We can talk about fishing rights, a whole other kettle of fish to really beat a bad cliche. We're talking legally. You're a legal scholar, but I wonder what attitudinally how various tribes view same-sex marriage. Is homosexuality? I've read differing accounts that, you know, it was fine, it was accepted by tribes, it was viewed as divine, various kinds of things like that.
It's one of those things that it's just impossible to make any broad statement about Indians and Alaska Natives. You just can't do it. And you're going to find examples on both sides of the spectrum. So you will find absolutely cultures that were historically, and I'm going out on a limb a little bit. I think if you look at traditions of the tribe pre-contact, there wasn't a holy text like the Bible that sort of had its effect on the beliefs of the tribe. Now, since contact, though, from tribe to tribe, you'll see different levels to which Christianity has been accepted by that tribe. So you have some very conservative tribes in this country, very conservative mm-hmm. tribes in this country, depending on, you know, how strongly they adopted Christianity and for a variety of reasons. And those tribes are uncomfortable with same-sex marriage. Other tribes are, I don't even want to say, you know, don't want to say tolerated. It's just, it's a different dynamic. So, for instance, at my tribe, I like to give this as an example. We had one of the members of our community who's homosexual, and he ran for tribal council and was elected. And at no time during any of the discussions about whether or not he should or should have been elected, I didn't hear any conversations about his sexual preference as being relevant. It just wasn't relevant. And he's lived on the reservation for his entire life, I think, and I think his partner lives with him on the reservation. And it doesn't mean that it's there's not going to be members of the tribe who agree with that, but it doesn't seem to be part of the fabric of shock or anger or hostility. Now, that, like I said, I could, that's a very – it's 1,200 people
right.
As members of my tribe. That's my little sample here. Mm-hmm. But from what I can tell from growing up in the tribal community, I would say the general trend across the country is that tribes are, again, more comfortable with it. And some tribes have very strong placement of that within their religious, mm-hmm. Traditional religion and what it means. And so because of that, you can have within a tribe groups that are totally fine and groups that would be concerned. And that's always going to be in the discussion. And that was the discussion at Suquamish. Not everybody at Suquamish supported it. Somebody ran for council who, as part of their platform, is that they were concerned and would like to have the law changed and were not elected at Suquamish. So it's a, you know, no matter where you are, you're just like in regular society, you're going to have parts of the tribe that are fine with it and parts of the tribe that are unsure and parts of the tribe that are anti.
Well, it's a fascinating subject, both the cultural aspect and the legal aspect. Ron Whitener is the executive director of the Native American Law Center at the University of Washington, also director of the Tribal Court Criminal Defense Clinic and a senior law lecturer at the University of Washington. Thank you for coming in.
Oh, my pleasure.
This is Weekday on KUOW.
A journey into the world of telescopes and test tubes in a minute.
Support for KUOW comes from BECU, a member-owned, not-for-profit credit union that offers financial services to its members and supports the communities where they live. BECU has more than 800,000 members and is growing. Information about services online at becu.org.
59 degrees and sunny in Seattle, expecting sun all day with an afternoon high of 78. You know who Beverly Washburn is? Even if you don't recognize her name, you might recognize her on screen. As a little girl, she appeared in the film Old Yeller and then went on to act in many TV shows and movies alongside lots of big names like Lou Costello and Bing Crosby. Imagine the stories she could tell. Well, you don't have to imagine. We're going to hear Beverly Washburn tell those stories in 20 minutes.
From KUOW, I'm Marcy Silman. Today we launch officially a weekly segment focusing on science and scientific research, health and medicine. We hope to be able to spotlight new work, discoveries, and a whole kind of world of stories that we don't always talk about here on Weekday. So to inaugurate this segment, we welcome science journalist Sally James to our studios. She's been writing about medicine and health for more than 15 years, and you can read her at seattlesciencewriter.com, her blog. Thanks for coming in.
You're welcome. Thanks for having me.
We'll start with the hard and heavy medical news. In China, a very deadly strain of bird flu has appeared that is jumping from, I believe, from chickens to humans.
That's what they think, although I'm not sure they've identified the exact way that this has happened. They're arguing about ducks and chickens.
But it's some sort of poultry. And this is concerning because the mortality rate was quite high for this strain of flu.
Yes, and it's part of influenza A is the family of viruses that it's part of, and they're known for being trickier. The body's immune response for influenza A is not as effective.
So this is, I wrote down the strain because I always, the numbers they give it always are so mysterious. H7N9. People might remember H1N1, easy ones. That was the couple years ago, and a lot of people got inoculated against this H7N9, brand new strain. This hasn't, it hasn't jumped across the Pacific Ocean to here yet.
No, it has not. One of the interesting things about it is how rapidly the response. So the scientists, some of the government labs in the U.S. are working on what they call an assay or a test that will actually identify it more quickly. And one of the Pullman researchers, Terry McIlwain at Washington State University, he does surveillance on birds. So he regularly tests our birds. And right now, all he can do is test them for whether they have influenza A, but wow, not for H7N9.
Is he talking about crop birds or wild birds?
Wild birds.
How do you test wild birds? How does that happen?
I'm pretty sure they have to capture them first.
I would imagine so. Is monitoring of you know, if you ran a poultry farm of whatever type, is that something, if you were here, that you'd be concerned about the presence of some sort of influenza?
If I'm a poultry
farmer, yeah,
I don't think yet. But I think this is the sort of thing that, you know, that's a great comment. I haven't called any, you know, poultry farmers. I've only talked to scientists locally. Mm-hmm. But everyone that has either an economic or a medical reason to pay attention to this is paying attention right now.
So this Washington State University professor has this test. Are there other local scientists who are involved in working on this?
There are. There's a lab at UW that's called the Katz Lab, K-A-T-Z-E. And Michael Katz and Lawrence Jossett, or Jose, I apologize, I don't know the pronunciation. They are both part of a lab that regularly analyzes viruses. And they are working on, one of the things scientists want to be able to do is model how a virus is going to behave. And as information comes out about H7N9, they're using every bit of that to try to begin to model what's going to happen with it.
How long does that sort of work take?
Well, you know, it gets compressed by new technologies and new insights. If you're watching this, part of what is fascinating is to watch how our response this time maybe is better and more efficient than the last mm-hmm. outbreak. But there was a sort of a, there's a, Michael Osterholm is a leading epidemiologist. And yesterday he did an opinion piece in the New York Times saying, we suffer pandemic fatigue. He thinks the public thinks, oh yeah, it's another thing from China.
this one's pretty deadly though.
Yeah. And he argues that, we can't really afford to think of it as crying wolf.
We're talking with science writer Sally James about some of the stories making headlines. Since you mentioned labs, I'm curious, one bigger story than scientific has been the federal budget sequester. And I'm wondering, when you talk about labs that are jumping on things like virology, what happens when federal funds get cut?
Well, some people probably heard U.S. Senator Patty Murray was in town, I think, last week at Fred Hutch. And some of the material that they presented to her made it sound dire. Fred Hutch said they were going to lose $40 million this year because of sequester cuts. And
that's a lot of money.
They said $3 million a month. Sounds like a lot to me.
I don't know how much that sort of research costs, but obviously it's millions of dollars. So that essentially that means that work might just grind to a halt.
I think rather than grinding to a halt, I think what's more likely to happen is a study that's already in progress will enroll fewer patients, or some of the lab work will take more time because there's less staff. And how that, I don't think any of us really know for sure how that actually plays out in terms of human, you know, discoveries that matter to patients.
Yeah, it could be serious. It sort of brings me around to a new way of funding, which there's a sort of DIY lab work going on. Now, you sent this to me. I hadn't heard about it. A student at Seattle's Ingram High School has helped crowdsource funding for original scientific research. Is this for real?
It's for real. Her name is Catriona Guthrie Hone, and I apologize, Catriona, if I'm not saying your name right. And she went on to a crowdfunding site called MicroRiza, and she asked for about $5,000 because she wanted a do-it-yourself biological lab where she could go do research. And she's raised more than $6,000 already, had someone donate the space and the money. The $6,000 is going to go for things like beakers and reagents and all the parts of a lab that have to be bought.
The site was called, with the MicroRiza, but Hive Bio Community Lab. This isn't just her own project. She's working with other people.
No, she has a partner, a very great partner who's already a research scientist.
Is this something that's particular to the Pacific Northwest, or are we, I mean, we hear about things like Kickstarter funding art projects, but this is the first that I've read. You know, I'm just imagining those researchers at the Hutch, if you guys are listening, you know, you can go to the site and start raising that $40 million that the government's going to cut. I mean, are we peculiar here?
Oh, well, I do. I think we're delightfully peculiar. But there is one other science crowdfunding site. I think my scientist friends, especially in medicine, harumph and say that the amounts raised are not enough to do what they, you know, basic science is a kind of million-dollar proposition.
Right.
But what may happen is that a scientist can do a project, maybe raise $40,000 on MicroRiza, and the small success will leverage into something, and then they can get the $10 million.
Yeah. Well, I was also curious that this was a high school student. I'm not sure if she's graduating this year or not, but I would think if I were in the world of science, this would be a really nice ray of sunshine, or at least optimism, that kids and girls, there's a lot of hand-wringing and lamentation about the future of science in America. This would appear to be a bright spot.
She's a triple threat, you know, young, female, and STEM, which for those of you that don't know is science, technology, engineering, and math, and an area of education that's has some of its own major nonprofits working on it. I think her college essay is...
Yeah, Britain
is a slam dunk. Yeah,
you haven't visited this lab. Do you know if it's set up yet? Where is it's not going to be at the school. It's a private lab.
It's not going to be at the school, and I haven't visited. And I'm kind of waiting, you know, anxiously. I'm not sure there's a physical place to visit yet. I think everyone was thrilled that she raised the money so fast.
But it was quick, wasn't it?
Yes, it was.
Well, there seems, as you mentioned, you know, if you raise 40,000, you might not raise 40 million, but you could raise 40,000. But it also is an interesting option, it seems, because the researchers, and we have so many of them in our community, because they're heavily dependent on federal funding for a lot of these projects, including the new brain science study, the Allen Brain Foundation, you know, Brain Institute will be taking in tens of millions of dollars for their studies. It'd be nice to diversify the funding source so if something dries up, there's another way to do it. I'm not saying Hive Bio is the way, but
yeah.
Maybe.
Well, one thing that happened just today, another news item, is that an atmospheric scientist in, I think, 72 hours, maybe it was 4 days, raised enough to finance his own coal study of coal dust.
Mm-hmm. Danny Westneat wrote about that in the Seattle Times, I saw. So people really are taking a clue from all those artists who are trying to self-fund. So we're going to see DIY science.
DIY, yeah.
Sally James writes about science and medicine and health. She's based in Seattle. And her website, if you want to read more, is seattlesciencewriter.com. That's all one word. And welcome and thank you for helping us kick off a weekly segment on science and health.
Thanks. I'm a fan.
This is Weekday on KUOW.
Now we turn from science to the silver screen. A conversation with child movie star Beverly Washburn is just a minute away.
Support for KUOW comes from Seattle Children's. Its new cancer, critical, and emergency care expansion, nicknamed Building Hope, provides more beds, advanced technology, and a healing, family-centered environment for children and teens. More at seattlechildrens.org/buildhope.
During our sound check with Swedish guitar rocker Yngwie Malmsteen, we sprang this on him.
Paganini. 16th Caprice.
Says he was inspired by Paganini and another guy named Hendrix.
And I wanted to play guitar so I can learn how to smash it up and burn it.
The king of neoclassical shred guitar, Saturday on Weekend Edition from NPR News.
That's tomorrow morning on KUOW 94.9 Seattle.
Support for KUOW comes from Nissan and the 100% electric Nissan Leaf, whose drivers have driven more than 150 million miles gas-free. More at NissanUSA.com.
I'm Bernard Ouellette. It's 9:35. 59 degrees in Seattle. Oops, just clicked up to 60. The sky is blue, the sun is shining, and we expect to reach 78 this afternoon. As for the weekend, well, we'll get an in-depth look at the weekend weather forecast in 15 minutes.
Chances are that you have seen Beverly Washburn in movies and on TV. You just didn't know who she was. You didn't know her name. So, Katie Sewell, have you seen that Walt Disney movie, Old Yeller?
Oh, yeah. Probably about 30 times, maybe.
Because you're a dog fan.
Well, and I don't think you could be a child in the 80s and not watch that movie hundreds of times,
yes,
possibly. How about yourself?
You've... I have. I cried. I saw and I cried.
Yes. It is not for the faint of heart. Well, that's the movie that most listeners would recognize Beverly from. She played the little girl, Lisbeth,
wow,
in that film.
Oh.
But her career started a lot earlier than that, believe it or not. She started at age 3. And she had the opportunity to act opposite all of the greats of Hollywood. She was in town last year for the Radio Enthusiasts of Puget Sound Convention, and I talked to her.
I had an older sister and an older brother that were in the business, and my mother, of course, got me an agent, and I would go around on all the auditions, but I would never get the part because I had no credits. One day I was in Long Beach with my older sister. We were doing a benefit for the veterans, and I met Jock Mahoney, the range rider, and Yancey Derringer.
Well, good evening, Mr. Colton. I don't see your Indian friend behind you.
Oh, he's not behind me. He's behind you.
And I was 6 at the time, and I just fell in love with him because he was just, you know, this cowboy. And so we talked, and as fate would have it, a couple months later, I was at Columbia, and there was a movie called The Killer That Stalked New York.
On a November day in 1947, without either gun or knife, one person was able to bring terror to the hearts of 8 million people.
It was called The Killer That Stalked New York because Evelyn Keyes played a carrier of smallpox, so everybody that she would come in contact with would get smallpox. The role that I was up for, it was a part of a little girl named Walda Kowalski, but in the script it said sitting in the waiting room was little Walda Kowalski with her big brown eyes and her long brown hair, which wasn't really pertinent to the storyline, but sometimes when they write, they envision what they want. So my mother, being very sweet and supportive, when she saw that, she turned to me and she said, just go in, honey, and, you know, do your best, but you're probably not going to get the part because you're not really what they're looking for. Well, just then, Jock Mahoney came walking through the lobby, and he remembered me, and he asked my mother why I was there, and she said, oh, she's auditioning for this part. So he said, okay, wait a minute. So he went into the producer and he said, oh, this kid's done this and she's done that. And I hadn't done a thing, but he had some clout because he was under contract. So they brought me in and I read for the part and I got the role. In the scene, I'm in the waiting room at this doctor's office and I admire Evelyn Keyes' brooch that she's wearing. And consequently, I get smallpox and I die. So I died in my first role. Once I had that speaking role under my belt, it was easier to go on from there. I did a movie with Bing Crosby and Jane Wyman called Here Comes the Groom, and I was the French war orphan that he adopted.
Another thing, don't ever be a bachelor. You spend years building yourself up into a respectable citizen, then you try and adopt somebody. They think you're a cheat, you're a thief, a crook, a
liar. You are adopting somebody, Pete.
Why do you think I've been chasing all over France? You and I are taking a plane for America today. How's Susie taking it, Bob?
She is as glad as I am, Pete.
Oh, good. I was a little worried about Susie, you know.
Oh, Susie does not care where she goes as long as she is with me.
I didn't mean Susie, too.
Not Susie.
Why, no. I thought you understood.
Oh. Can't kill Dave?
All right, Susie. Where were you born?
She wouldn't know.
She wouldn't know.
And after that, I did Shane with Alan Ladd, and then Superman and the Mole Man. I was the little girl with the Mole Man climbing through the window, and that was with George Reeves.
Hello. Who are you? If you don't want to talk or look at any of my books, maybe you'd like to play catch.
Segued into TV and did the Jack Benny show, where I was planted in the audience, and it was back in the days of live TV. He's doing his monologue, and suddenly I get up out of my seat and I go up on stage.
What is it? What is it, little girl?
Mr. Benny, can I have your autograph, please?
My autograph? Oh, well, that's sweet. I mean, but honey, look at it. If you'll just wait until after the show.
Okay.
Yeah, that's cute. Oh, wait a minute, honey, come back here. Come back. I mean, as long as you came up like this, I mean, it's cute. I'll give you the autograph. I'll be very happy to. What's your first name, honey?
Margaret.
Margaret, huh? I'll tell you what I'll do. I'll put to Margaret from Jack Benny. Huh? How do you spell that, honey?
B-E-N-N-Y.
After that, Jack Benny asked me if I'd do a couple of his radio shows. And so I maintained this amazing relationship with him till the time he died. I traveled all over with him. We went to Scottsdale, Arizona, and then we were on the Hollywood Palace.
I'll bet you have most of the boyfriends crazy about you.
Well,
I mean, now how many boyfriends have you got?
Well, I'd rather not say.
Why, are you bashful?
No, I'm married.
So give people who never got a chance to meet Jack Benny a sense of what he was like to be around.
The thing about Jack Benny is that he always portrayed the stingy tightwad, and he was truly the most generous man I've ever known. When I had my appendix out when I was 18, he sent these beautiful flowers, and of course, you know, the nurses were just like so overwhelmed to see a bouquet from Jack Benny, as was I. And then when my daddy was dying, Jack Benny actually sent over his own personal physician at his expense. I just feel so blessed that I knew him. And I think the sad part is, as you get older, you know, you look back and so many of the legends are gone. You know, there'll never be another Jack Benny. There'll never be another Loretta Young. Or memories are some of the things that I just hold so dear to my heart.
Well, and I suppose because you were a young person, and in some cases when you met them you were really young, did they all take you under their wing in sort of a mentoring way?
I did most of my work as a child. As I got older, of course, I did the movie Old Yeller, which most people seem to remember me for. I was the little girl, Elizabeth. But, you know, when you're so young, like Here Comes the Groom was directed by Frank Capra, and The Greatest Show on Earth, Cecil B. DeMille. But when you're so young, it doesn't mean anything to you because you don't grasp that. And like when I did Superman and the Mole Man, working with George Reeves meant nothing to me, but working with Superman is what it was all about for me. And he was on the set, you know, in his Superman costume, and I was just in awe. A couple months after that, I was cast in a film called Heart of Gold, and George Reeves and Anita Louise were our parents. Well, it was very confusing for me because I'm on the set, and I'm about 8 years old, and I'm hearing people talking about him being Superman. And now all of a sudden he's my dad. And so I couldn't quite, you know, I wasn't a very bright child, I guess. I don't know. But I did quite get how he was Superman and now he's my dad. So my mother, bless her heart, I guess she didn't want to burst my bubble. She told me that he really was Superman, that he was just play acting.
I'm speaking with Beverly Washburn. She was a child star of film and TV. I'm of the generation that was raised on Old Yeller. So what was it like to work on that movie?
It was probably one of my favorite roles that I ever did. In Old Yeller, there were only 7 people. There were no supporting players or background players, extras. Or anything. It was just 7 of us working for 3 months. And Old Yeller, he was actually a rescue dog. His name was Spike. And, you know, like with Rin Tin Tin and Lassie, they would have several German Shepherds and several collies to do the various scenes, depending on which dog could do whatever they needed to do better at the time. But in Old Yeller, they only had one because they rescued him, so he did everything.
It was him what done it.
What done what?
What stole all them eggs and bread and meat and stuff.
You mean Old Yeller?
I seen him suck a batch of eggs. Seen him swipe a pan of grandma's cornbread, too, that I ain't gonna tell.
He had his own dressing room, which I think was bigger than mine. I see Tommy Kirk from time to time, who was Travis in Old Yeller. I have to tell you a funny story. We were doing an autograph show 1 year, about 3 or 4 years ago, and they had Tommy and I sitting at a table, and we had all our stills and all the, you know, the clippings and the lobby cards and everything from Old Yeller. And we were sitting side by side, and this lady came up, and she looked at our pictures, and then she looked at Tommy, and then she looked at me, and then she looked at the pictures again, and then she looked back up, and she said, "Oh my goodness, I can't believe this. Old Yeller was probably one of my favorite movies. I must have seen it 20 times, and it's so amazing to me that you're both still alive." But Old Yeller was a classic film, and it's true that I've had many a man come up to me and say, "It's too sad. You know, it's like one of the saddest movies." That TV show, I can't even think of it, where they ask questions, and one of the questions was, name the 5 saddest movies of all time.
Family Feud.
Family Feud. And Old Yeller was number 2, and Bambi was number 1.
Oh, really? Mm.
Yeah. And then somebody said to me, they said, "Wow, you know, like, deep down, Walt Disney must not have liked animals, because they all die." It's like, what's up with that?
What you read about you online all the time is that one of your greatest skills was that you could cry on cue.
I don't know what's up with that. I just have overactive tear ducts or something. I don't know. It just seems that in every role that I was ever cast, for whatever reason, I always had to cry. In fact, another little autograph show I did one time, and a man came up to me and he said, "You know, when I read that you were going to be here, I couldn't really place you. I couldn't put the name with the face. But now that I see you in all these pictures, now I remember you. You were that little girl that was always crying and whining."
You're like, "Yes, I was."
Yeah, so that's my claim to fame. I could cry on cue.
I was going to ask you about Lou Costello, because you were opposite him in his only dramatic role ever.
It was Wagon Train.
"Toby, please hurry. They'll be coming any minute."
"I gotta have my cough medicine."
"Well, you didn't have to try and drink it all at once."
He was so adorable because he had a really difficult time memorizing his dialogue, because when he did Abbott and Costello, he pretty much had free rein. He could ad-lib. And in this, they wanted him to stick to the dialogue. So every time he would go up on his lines and, like, totally forget what he was going to say, instead of just stopping, he would look straight into the camera and go, "So how are ya?" And he would do that every time. He was adorable. And sadly, he died not too long after that. His son had drowned, and he had kind of almost like this sad aura around him. You could kind of feel he was a dear man, but they said he never really recovered from his son drowning. But he was just one of the most favorite people that I've ever worked with.
That's former child actor Beverly Washburn. She spoke with Katie Sewell. Beverly is best remembered for her role as Lisbeth in the Disney film Old Yeller. She's going to be a guest at the radio showcase put on by radio enthusiasts of Puget Sound. That's coming up in June. For more information, you can visit repsshowcase.com. Thank you.
And now.
And now.
This is the sound of the week. The sound of the week. Unmistakable sounds of summer, even though it's still spring. We received a variety of great frog sounds over the past few months, and that was a compilation of them. You heard coqui frogs from Puerto Rico and Pacific chorus tree frogs. Sounds were recorded everywhere from backyards, green belts, walks in parks, even in a neighbor's swimming pool. I want to thank listeners Joel, Jeffrey, Christy, Nancy, Patty, Tim, and Carrie for sending those sounds in, and maybe we can hear a few more frogs, little more frog sound.
Oh, you want some more frogs?
I like frogs. So I was trying to decide if it was frogs I heard outside my bedroom window the other night or birds at dusk.
And perhaps a combination of the two.
It could have been. I guess I should go out there with a flashlight and check. What interesting sounds are you listening to in your world? Could be frogs, could be birds, could be anything. Record 30 seconds and send that sound to us along with the story behind your recording. Email it to weekday@kuow.org and make sure you include sound of the day in the subject line. And I'm thinking that it's time for bullfrogs pretty soon, so I didn't hear any in that compilation. Well, those were sounds of summer, and we've had more than a week of summertime weather, but Washington State climatologist Nick Bond, things are going to shift this weekend, right?
Yeah, but we have a couple of good days in store, especially today. We should get into the high 70s with abundant sunshine, maybe even some of the warmer spots cracking the 80 barrier.
Wow.
And then tomorrow looks okay. Also, some middle and high clouds moving in kind of later in the day, heralding the rain that's going to come in for Mother's Day. And then Monday looks like definitely kind of a rainy day, just back down into the low 60s, and that continuing into Tuesday. But I don't think the week ahead is going to be a washout by any means.
I have to ask you a question before we talk about the change per se, that this morning was clear, but the past couple of mornings have been overcast with mid-afternoon clearing. Why do we see that some days and perfectly clear through the whole day other days?
Yeah, that's a good question, and it's actually a really tricky to forecast. And certainly we know when the pressure gradients are such that there's higher pressure out over the ocean and lower pressure inland, that tends to push in the marine air result in those low clouds that can kind of stubbornly last almost all day, especially on Wednesday. That was the case. We kept expecting them to burn off, and they just didn't. Yesterday, it was actually a pretty heavy fog in the morning, but since it was a thinner layer and there wasn't quite as much of this push from the coast to inland, they actually burned off around lunchtime or so.
Which was the case on Tuesday as well. But then this morning that was gone and it was clear.
Yeah, that's right. And now there were some patches in spots, but in the populated regions of the Sound, it was a much more clear morning. But you can imagine how that there are forecasters that are the aviation forecasters that are forecasting specifically for the airports and what kind of visibility and ceilings there are and how difficult that is, because just very small changes in the weather pattern can make all the difference between, well, sunshine and fog.
Right. Now, last week, Nick, when we spoke, you were saying, well, you know, it is a little bit warmer than usual, but, you know, it's not crazy historical record breaking, but now we're into the, we've seen these like 10 days of gorgeousness, and we are into the record-breaking point of discussion, right?
Yeah, that's right. I took a look at the climate record, and assuming that it will not rain today, and that's a very good assumption, the first 10 days of this month of May are going to be completely dry at the airport, and there's no previous precedent for that in the record at SeaTac that goes back to 1948.
Wow, that goes, that's pretty far. And my question to you last week, and the same question I have this week, is, well, you know, it's, I've enjoyed it. I'm sure there's people who haven't. I personally have enjoyed it, but what does it all mean?
Yeah, and other people have been asking me that, and you know, some have been saying, is there going to be some sort of cosmic payback and
exactly
rains in our future, or is the rainy season basically over? And I think it's probably more of the latter. And in particular, when I've looked at past Mays that had, the early part has been on the warm, dry side, generally the rest of the month kind of continues in that same vein. But I put a lot more stock into the kind of climate models that we have available now that we use for seasonal weather forecasting. And they're not unanimous, but four out of six of them indicate a warmer and drier conditions basically continuing into the foreseeable future.
Does this have anything to do with whether we're in an El Nino or a La Nina year?
Well,
I can't remember which one we're in.
It's kind of neutral conditions.
Oh.
And this time of year, it doesn't have a huge effect on our weather. And so it's kind of, it is a difficult time to do seasonal forecasts because we don't have that sort of crutch to lean on. But at any rate, these models that we have at our disposal are getting better. They're far from perfect, and especially as a group, when they're indicating certain conditions, you have to kind of take notice of them. And I should add that, of course, that doesn't mean every day is going to be warm and sunny. And in fact,
darn,
we'll see that Sunday, and Monday is going to be a pretty rainy day. But overall, I think our the remainder of spring and into early summer is going to be a bit nicer, at least, than the last few that we've had around here.
So if you were planning to have Aunt Minnie and Uncle Joe visit you from out of state, and you wanted to show them the glories of the Pacific Northwest, this is the summer that you should invite them?
Oh, well, yeah. You know, basically all our summers are really nice here. And
when they start, when they finally begin, they're nice.
Yeah. But even so, I mean, compared to some of the rains that have plagued, you know, the farmers in the Midwest, and of course some of the really hot conditions and drought that's in occurring in the Southern Plains and Southern Rockies, we have it pretty good here.
Paradise.
Yeah,
just like paradise. Well, Nick Bond, not in the pocket of the Washington State Chamber of Commerce, but an independent scientist, thanks once again for your sunny forecast, at least today, partly sunny tomorrow, and the rain comes in for Mother's Day. Thanks for being with us.
Yeah, my pleasure.
Nick Bond is Washington State climatologist. He works at the Joint Institute for the Study of Atmosphere and Ocean, and he's with us every Friday with the weekend forecast, which, again, get out there today and probably tomorrow. Coming up, Bernard Ouellette, in the next hour, we're going to talk over the week's news. Got our panel of journalists chomping at the bit out there.
They're getting ready to bust into the door right now.
As we speak.
We're holding them back just for a few more minutes.
We can't wait, and we'd like to hear from you. Weekday at KUOW.org is our email address, and we'll be talking about that soon.
It's 9:59. This Sunday, the day after tomorrow, is Mother's Day, and we want to know, what was the best or worst advice that your mother ever gave you? Something mom told you that stayed with you through the years, for whatever reason. Pass that wisdom on to others by calling 206-221-3663. Now, we're talking about mom's good advice or bad. Tell us at 206-221-3663. Mom said, today at noon. KUOW FM Seattle, KUOW Tumwater, KQOW Bellingham, and Digital HD Services.
Support for KUOW comes from Washington Energy Services, featuring energy-efficient products since 1957 to fit individual home, lifestyle, and budget. Windows, heating and cooling systems, water heaters, and more. Products, installation, and service information online at WashingtonEnergy.com.
Swing through Saturday night with music of the 1920s through the 1950s and beyond on the Swing Years. I'm Amanda Wild. Join me for adventures in popular music of the 20th century, the Swing Years, 7 p.m. to midnight, Saturday nights on 94.9 KUOW.
Support for KUOW comes from LeMay, America's Car Museum, which celebrates its first anniversary with a...
Thanks for listening. The program you just heard was made possible by the financial support of our listeners. Support this program and others like it by making a pledge today at KUOW.org.